Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 49. On this episode, we are talking about Unbroken. Unbroken is the true story of Louis Zamperini, who started his life as an immigrant, became an Olympian, worked his way to becoming a bombardier in World War II in the Pacific Theater, and eventually ended up in a Japanese prisoner of war camp where he was tortured and put through all kinds of things that we can not even imagine. The amazing thing about Louis is that he probably lived multiple lifetimes in only one, and it's hard to imagine one person going from such a major event to such a major event and living through so many things, especially in this day and age. So his story gives us a lot to talk about, from, you know, eventually forgiving our enemies, forgiving those who persecute us. It makes us question what drives us to persevere. His story is billed as a story of redemption, and that is where we get some of the controversy, because there is a contingent of Christians who really focus in on his later life when he was saved and became a Christian, and that led to how he reframed his entire life. But in this story, Angelina Jolie, the director, only tells it up to a certain point, and we kind of wrestle with that conflict between the story that we're aware of and the story that's told specifically in this movie, and come out in a couple different places, some positive, some negative. And so, we really try to break down what this movie tells us, what this movie conveys, and we kind of compare that to what we know of Louis' story, what his family wanted conveyed from his story, and just what we can learn from that. So, it's a great episode, great conversation with Laura Fissel, Joe Darnell, who's been on the show before. So, I think you'll really enjoy it. So, here it is, episode 49, Unbroken and Partially Told Stories. Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless.
I'm not gonna be a part of it.
You're not. You're totally. Anyway, you have to have a girl. It is known, Laura.
You have to have like female cred.
You have to have like a female nerd thing. There's an appeal.
Yeah.
Because
always becomes the popular one.
Exactly, because there's like your two hardest to get audiences are going to be drawn in by a female, and that's females and hardcore nerds that like always know better than you about every topic. But they'll listen because there's this hope that there's a girl out there who likes nerdy things. So she gets those two groups, and then someone like me and Mark, who just I think are better
the
and
ones
charismatic.
That actually have the knowledge and the talent and the
we're just charismatic to get the everyman. You know? And then and then you being the anomaly and bringing solid content and opinions.
Okay.
Like I said, I think we...
As long as there's solid content and opinions.
There is. I think... I think we'd run the whole gamut. It would be great. But...
Because both things you mentioned were just, you know, me being a female is all that required.
And I don't want to say it like that.
But it's kind of true.
But it's true. You know, like, I don't wish it was like that. But at the end of the day, that's exactly what marketers do. Like, they go out, they do market research, they're like, hey, we're going to have this TV show, and it's going to have this person, this person, this person in it. So when we throw this group of roommates together, we got to make sure we have the Asian guy and the black guy, you know, and the funny guy who's not very attractive, but everyone likes him because he's funny.
Yeah.
You know? And
I thought that my favorite show of all time, Doctor Who, did not do that kind of nonsense until I read this like book, history book that Mikey got me for Christmas.
Yeah.
About the first 50 years of Doctor Who, and that's exactly what they did.
Yeah. I mean,
that's like, how the characters on Doctor Who became what they are.
That's how the characters on most shows are. That's why almost every character you see is some type of stereotype, and their flaws are usually predictable, mm-hmm. just as much as their strengths are predictable. You know, because, like, you rarely have a super good-looking person in the apartment who's not also really bad at, like, either social interaction or they're just not very smart.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, they have, like, the thing that you can make fun of if you're not the, if you're the unattractive person watching the show.
Right.
You know, you're like, well, I'm smart, like the smart, funny guy, you know, even though he's not the super, you know, whatever. Like, yeah. So everything works out. And then that's why when you watch sitcoms, they almost always go through the same patterns of episodes. Where it's like, hey, the super sexy guy has a girl that he likes, but doesn't really like her, but the nerdy guy does. And so the nerdy guy's really nice to her all the time. And then once the super handsome guy realizes the nerdy guy shows him how great the girl is, then he starts being interested in her, and it breaks the nerdy guy's heart. And then we have that thing, and then they're roommates, and hijinks ensue. Or, you know, like, it's like... Everything happens
yes,
like that.
Yes, I recognize patterns. And
yes, we've all seen the Big Bang Theory. We understand how this works.
Yeah.
Don't pick on certain shows.
Certain shows that
even
are...
Even if they're easy targets.
Obvious and pandering. So, I mean... So yeah, anyway...
We love the opinion of this podcast does not reflect...
That's right.
The opinions of Michael Fissell do not necessarily reflect that of Real World Theology.
You need that disclaimer just in case. Big Bang Theory comes knocking for some podcasts.
Oh, gosh. It's one of my favorite things. It's one of my favorite things about the Storymen, because they'll always be like, or gosh, someone will make fun, you know, because JR is not a huge fan of Tom Hanks. And so he'll be like, I just don't like Tom Hanks. He plays the same character in every movie. That said, Tom Hanks, if you would want to come out here and defend the characters that you play, we would love to have you. We really respect your work. They, like, you know, they caveat it, like, after every time they do the thing, you know, stuff like that. It's great. It's just having that rapport, I think, works. And, you know, I think that's why there's certain shows that really, really click, because they take a chance and they do something different. At least for a while.
Are we talking television shows or podcasts?
Both.
Television. Yeah. Well, we were talking television shows.
I mean, because people want something different. The problem is when you're different, it's hard to make it past that initial, you know. It's kind of like you're saying, you know, how do you get... You can't have sponsors until you have listeners, and typically you can't have listeners without the money to really push your podcast out there. So...
Man, I've let so many, like, segues pass by between our conversation and this movie.
I know.
Because I was about to say, hey, being safe, that's one of the problems I have with this movie.
Well, I would say this. So talking about Unbroken, when I think about Unbroken, one of the weirdest things to me, and was pointed out in a couple reviews that I've read about it, is it has a whole bunch of really talented people behind it.
It sure does.
And in it. Mm-hmm. You know, people who want the movie to be made, people who made the movie, people who are acting in the movie, people who have creative license in the movie, and the person that the movie's about is an incredible person. Mm-hmm. An incredible human being that, you know, has done, you know, more than, you know, 100 people will ever do in their lifetime. Unfortunately for those 100 people.
Speaking of some of those talented people, did you know that the Coen brothers were some of the writers?
Yeah, that's
such a big deal, and that's something that nobody's talked about. You know, you get the name drop of Angelina Jolie and Laura Hillenbrand, and it stops at that. But the writers have a lot to do with the success or failure of the film, and perhaps this is part of the problem that the Coen brothers and other writers wrote the screenplay the way that they would. Like, visualize, if I were the director, I would mm-hmm. write it this way for my sake, and then when I was in the director's chair, I'd execute it on my plan. Mm-hmm. But then you get Angelina Jolie, who has less experience in the director's chair, so she's taking the great works of the Coen brothers, and then she's, like, still got the learning curve there. Obviously, she knows more about the director's chair than I do, but I think that... we're still seeing that she's wet behind the ears when it comes to directing. She's got a few other films already on you know, scheduled for release in the few year, next few years, and that's saying something for her future filmography career. But it's just maybe a little bit of a shame that this one came so early in her director experience. And I don't want to say that Angelina failed us, because she does much better than I think a lot of new directors would do. And you know what I'm saying? Did y'all get did y'all get that feeling?
Well, I mean, I think I feel like the choices she made that I was, if I could even say, disappointed in, are things that were actually sanctioned by the Zamperini family. I mean, they were things that were omitted from the overarching story that the original people, you know, that the story is about, said, yeah, let's do it that way, that we feel good about that. So I wonder if, it seems from the publicity that she didn't twist anyone's arm to leave out the parts that I felt had the most impact. So, I mean, maybe she did. Maybe that was a choice that she was really wedded to, and then they came on board. But it feels like everybody was really okay with how the film ended, and that, I mean, that's my biggest problem with it. I don't really, thinking about the rest of the movie, it feels like a pretty solid film to me. I can't think of anything that stands out that that I would, you know, I would say I wish it were a different way, except for
right.
Really the
yeah.
end.
Yeah, there isn't that one scene or that one character that, you know, constantly irks the film into failure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when I think of directing, I think of a director taking the story that they've been given and trying to translate that story, that narrative, into pictures in a way that conveys whatever story the writers are trying to, basically tell.
Mm-hmm.
And not only did the Coen brothers have a hand in this, but William Nicholson, Richard LaGravanes, Richard LaSomething, okay?
Let's good just job, say good that. Job. Didn't butcher
Richard
that.
Richard LaSomething. You know, and these are people who have had hands in writing movies like Gladiator and The Bridges of Madison County, like award-winning movies.
Mm-hmm.
So there are not just the Coen brothers, but like there's four writers mm-hmm. credited with writing this movie. And I think from at least what they tried to tell, or the portion of Zamperini's life that they wanted to show, that they gave us as much script as they could.
Mm-hmm.
And from that script, I think Jolie told about as good of a story as you can tell with a base story that misses the most important act.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and when I saw the trailer, when I saw the film, I was like 2/3 through the book. When I saw the trailer, I was like 1/3 through the book. And I had, you know, even within the first like 100 pages, I was like, how are they going to put all of this on screen? I mean, mm-hmm. like stuff just keeps happening to this guy.
Really?
But I think they did a great job. I mean, like, you know, he's got the troubled childhood thing. He's got the Olympic thing. He's got the bombardier thing. He's got the castaway thing.
Yes.
And then he has the POW thing. And I just feel like I was worried that they were going to have to gloss over something.
Right.
This
has
a
lot. It has more than three acts.
Oh,
and
yeah.
You remember any of the filmmaking ofs for the Indiana Jones series? They talk about how they took a serial approach, so different parts of the film feel like they're episodic. And this would be everything that would be the plot for one comic book about Indiana Jones.
Mm-hmm.
But then we put all of these together and we got one film out of it. So it feels like one overarching story in 2 hours, but it's also like several episodic things that are mm-hmm. happening along the way. And you got that experience in Unbroken, which is something I don't see very often in film in 2015 and 14. That it seems like one of the things that we are saying is that this film feels like it's pushing all the right buttons to try and become a huge success, a blockbuster smash, something that the Academy Awards will pay attention to because mm-hmm. it has to do with historical figures and a world war.
Mm-hmm.
But in some ways, I felt like they were being really especially creative, like with these various segments of the story, Laura, that felt like they could have been, you know, I know what it was. I hate to make this comparison because some of our audience probably has not seen The Sound of Music. But for those
clearly
people,
not.
Like me.
Yeah.
You've never, what?
Like I haven't seen The Sound of Music.
What?
And but for the sake of those people, I'll actually talk about John Adams instead. Both of those, yeah. Both
forget
of those,
The Sound of Music, yeah, completely. Yeah.
But both of those struck me when I was thinking about Unbroken. I was like, I wish that this was made more like, say, The Sound of Music, with a large intermission in between for two segments that could have been a movie unto themselves. And the second part was like, you know, part two of the continuing story for the Von Trapps. Where another approach that might have been taken, and I grant you this has not happened, and so we can see why this doesn't even matter. But another approach that may have been taken to make it work better is if this was actually a television miniseries. Mm-hmm. And flesh it out like the John Adams series, where you can explore more of his childhood and make characters of his parents, and then talk about his time in the Army and show more of the camaraderie he had with the pilots and the crew members while he was the bombardier. Yeah. And then another episode where it's all about the experience out there on the ocean, and you go all Life of Pi about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the next one where, you know, they get into the first phase of the POW, and then in maybe the second phase for the last mm-hmm. installment. That would have been so cool. I could still see this happening. And I think that you could flesh it out better.
Yeah. What did we see recently that we said the same thing about?
No, because I said the same thing about Interstellar.
Interstellar, yeah.
Because I think this is a credit to the quality of television that we're getting, and which is why occasionally on this podcast
we'll
bring this up and we'll actually not only review films, but we'll review TV shows.
Mm-hmm.
Because TV shows now are becoming basically like 1 9 or 10 or 11 hour movie.
Mm-hmm.
And for the most part, the ones that have done that, especially, you know, HBO is probably spearheading this now, they're really good 10 hour movies.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it speaks a lot to the quality of that we're so used to stories getting the time they need to be told in the way that they need to be told and how they need to be told, that we can tell when we're being robbed of a good story
mm-hmm.
or pieces of a good story or necessities of a good story by having to rush it. And I know I say this kind of humorously, rush it and squeeze it into 2.5 hours. So, I mean, so I feel that need for an intermission. And there are so many things that happened to Zamperini or that happened to Zamperini in his life. And I love where I tried to find like a good, you know, plot summation or plot synopsis, and I couldn't find one that really captured it. And then when I was reading Alyssa Wilkinson's Christianity Today one, I really liked how she put it, because she said this is the story of an immigrant kid who overcomes his misbehaving childhood to become an Olympic athlete, then a World War II bombardier. So he survives being shot down over the Pacific and then spending 47 days in a raft, only to be picked up by the Japanese, imprisoned, tortured, made the special personal target of a sadistic commander in a Japanese concentration camp, and then is beaten senseless over and over. And that's the synopsis of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, I think what I, you know, kind of want to take a step back from, so we can almost...
like frame the conversation.
Frame the conversation is... that's not actually the whole story of Zamperini.
Mm-hmm.
So not only did this movie give us enough of his life to create a miniseries, like Joe is suggesting, that I'm agreeing, and I think Laura would probably mm-hmm. agree to as well, that, you know, I would gladly watch that, you know, 6-episode Zamperini series. But this movie never gets probably to act 4 or 5 of his life,
mm-hmm.
which, if you... from what I understand of the book, what Laura's told me having read the book, that's the part that you can start talking about the, you know, the tagline of the film, with, you know, like with forgiveness and things like
yes.
that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, even the person who hasn't read the book knows that there's a whole side of the story that hasn't been told, because they tell it to us in small, like, you know, like couple of sentences at the end of the film. So mm-hmm. everybody knows, whether they've read the book or not, that there's more to this story.
Mm-hmm. So, so trying to take the film as it is, I think it's probably going to be, it's going to leave all three of us slightly dissatisfied. But where did you come out on the film itself. And have you read the book, Joe?
I have not, but now I really want to. I didn't know anything about Zamperini before. Sorry. Mm-hmm. And I was totally impressed.
So did you really enjoy this film?
Like, I did. I there's two wavelengths here. There's the one about, do I think that this film transcends, you know, our times? And is this a timeless classic? And is this something that I want to buy and share with everybody and tell my friends about and recommend highly for its, you know, super in-depth analysis of cultural blah, 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 blah. You know, if I could go that route, but then the other route could be, oh, do I like this film? Did it hit me where it hurts? Did it really grab me? Yeah. Ooh, yeah, I liked that. It touched all my right buttons. And ooh, I liked that too. And I like that character. And I kind of like him. He's a role model for me in my life. You know, when that happens, it hits you on a personal, is this one of my favorite movies? And this film fell a little bit on the flat side for a film that I think needs to excel when it comes to film craft and excellence in our medium today. But where it excelled for me very well was that I just really enjoyed the story. I really enjoyed ultimately what they did from start to finish. Like Laura, I didn't see that there was one particular thing that bugged me throughout the film, or in hindsight. You know, it's not like I'm going to tell my dad. My dad is really particular about movies. Kind of like, you know, I might be with eating my squash. And I would tell him, oh, Dad, you're going to love this movie. And he'd be like, okay, is there anything I need to watch out for? Is there anything I want to skip? Do I need to read this, you know, Christian website for its, you know, ultra conservative review to make sure that it's not got the inappropriate content? And I'd say, no, not really, Dad. This time you can eat the whole pizza, the whole enchilada. You're going to like it all. And Dad's more conservative than I am, but I honestly think he'd also just really enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
Where do y'all fall in this?
All right. Did I like this film? I was really excited about this film because I was in the process of reading the book and I had never heard of this guy before. And I don't know why. I mean,
how could you not hear about this guy? You know, it's like, it's one of those things when you do hear about him.
Yes.
You're like, how could I have never heard about this guy before?
And I mean, I felt the same way about Alan Turing from who was, you know, the focal point of The Imitation Game. But at least, like, his story was, like, it was a state secret. You know, it was like so he couldn't tell his story. But this one, like, and Louis has been traveling, telling his story all around the world. So I don't know how I've missed this story.
Kids these days.
So I was excited about it. And after I finished seeing it, I was like, that was a good movie. And then when people would ask me about it and if they should see it, I'd be like, well, it was a good movie. But there just hasn't been something for me where I was like, you have to see this movie. I mean, it just didn't take it to that level.
Mm-hmm.
And so I really was, it took me a couple of weeks to figure out what was like bugging me. And I hadn't even finished the book at the time. So all I knew about the end of his story was that he forgave his captors, according to the film, which seemed to me like a pretty big deal. But then I finished the book and I realized that, you know, there's a whole, finishing the book made me realize like what I unknowingly sensed about what was absent from the film. And that's that this whole concept of the title Unbroken is really, to me, a misnomer. I mean, even for the film that we saw, because he was broken. I mean, there was an enduring part of his spirit. There was like I don't even know what you could call it, but I mean, he was able to somehow bolster up under incredible odds and survive.
I think the way I would describe it is that he was emotionally broken, and as a man, he went through a transformation that was somewhat redemptive. He went from a silly boy to a mature man, and really the part that was unbroken was his integrity. Once he established it, it never broke.
Yeah.
But his integrity, kind of along the lines of what you're saying, is that the real reason that his integrity stands out to us is for what he did post-movie, post-Unbroken. Mm-hmm. In the film called Broken, the sequel to Unbroken.
Yeah.
that'd be where you see where he really made like a transformation.
Oh yeah. And I mean, yeah, I just felt like I watched a man, basically I watched a movie where a bunch of men were completely broken down. And so, I mean, what, at the end of the day from that film, what made Louis different from anybody else? And I mean, like, you could say, well, he survived 47 days on a raft before he came to the POW camp. But so did Phil. And Phil also survived. So what makes Louis' story something that everybody wants to hear? And I feel like it's because even though he was, in my assessment, broken emotionally, psychologically, and physically when he came back from Japan, he overcame that. And he did it because he did it from a spiritual experience. And he was able to forgive people that had caused him great pain, that he had like every right to despise and want revenge from. So to me, like, the whole thing that made his story, I don't even want to say like a step above other POWs, because they all have something important to say. Their stories all have something important to communicate. Right. But the reason why we're all gravitating towards it is because it is amazing, you know, and it's not just because he was an Olympic athlete.
Right.
So I think when I talk about if I enjoyed the film or not, yes, I enjoyed the film. I enjoyed watching this piece of our history. It was very well done and well acted, but there was really something missing at the end that I wasn't eager to go out and tell everybody to watch it. So I think that's where I'm sitting with it.
Okay.
Did it feel like to you, Mikey, that it was trying to reach the same people who enjoyed Chariots of Fire?
Have you seen Chariots of Fire, Mikey?
I have seen Chariots of Fire. And it's been a long time since I've seen Chariots of Fire. But I have seen Chariots of Fire. So I thought it was a perfectly okay film.
Mm-hmm.
If I wanted to watch a piece of almost like pseudo historical interpretation of events that had happened,
mm-hmm.
I felt like I got that. But I feel like the most important narrative, and now this is basically just on what Laura's telling me, so if I say this wrong, it's Laura's fault, because she's the
it's
one.
It's okay. I'll correct you.
Yeah, she's the one who's read the book. But this is going back to what Laura said earlier. You know, like, how could we not know who this guy is? Like, I didn't know who this guy was, and I love history. I love World War II history, and I can't believe I've never heard of this guy. And just you know, watching things and acquiring things and taking things in, but everyone knows that the most interesting part of his story is the fact that he went through hell, but he was able to forgive those people who persecuted him, which is not common. I mean, we had people sitting behind us in the theater who every time the Japanese were on torturing people, they, you know, you could hear them whispering like, "Oh, I hate them people, or I hope they die, I hope they all
right.
die."
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then, you know, then at the end, the message comes up, you know, and he forgave his captors. Obviously, forgiving his captors is not the thing that comes naturally to us or to anyone. So we need to see, what is that transition? What is that arc that takes him from just surviving physically to transforming spiritually, and something about his worldview shifting to be able to say, "I forgive you." You know, forgiveness is powerful than hatred.
Yeah.
Because I feel like we only saw half the story.
And even like the last thing that we saw, the last interaction we see, I think, between him and his you know, greatest tormentor, the bird, is complete. It's like rage and anger that is helping him to like push that, you know, rail tie over his head or whatever. So there's like a rage and an anger at his captor, and then there's forgiveness. And so there is a pretty big discrepancy there.
And I feel like the film itself only shows, like, what we're told is he's unbroken because in the end, you know, he's a whole person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's a whole person that's able to do something that most people can't do.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Well, when he was in the camp, when he was being tortured, it wasn't his love for Christ or his love for his enemy that was getting him through. Mm-hmm. So the only part of his story that we see in the movie is the part where he is hating his enemy more than his enemy hates him. Mm-hmm. And that's what's keeping him going. So when people see this movie, or when this movie is supposed to bill itself as inspirational
and redemptive.
Yeah. I'm like, where
there is a conflict there.
I'm like, mm-hmm. what is it inspiring us to do? It's inspiring us to look inward and to hate something more than failing. Mm-hmm. And I like I said, and that's my problem with this film. Because I thought technically I would think it was above average.
Yeah.
But I think the narrative itself, for something that is billing itself as inspirational, I feel like it stopped too soon before it got to the inspirational right. part. Just surviving something physically, to me, isn't the point.
Yeah.
It's why you survived and what you do with that. And so he survived because he hated.
Mm-hmm.
He survived because he was defiant.
And but he was healed because...
Yeah, but he came out, right. and the parts that Laura's told me from the book are the parts that you can read from, you know, any of his snippets from either interviews or people writing about his life is, you know, he went home and he held on to that anger so deeply that he would have nightmares. He woke up in the middle of the night trying to strangle his wife, having dreams that he was in a fight with the bird.
Mm-hmm. He was an alcoholic.
And he was an alcoholic.
He lost all his money. His wife was about to divorce him.
Yeah. How is that unbroken?
Yeah.
Like, I want to see how a man who went through all that and then comes home and is still even has further to sink. Because he sank physically in the war. He sank spiritually and morally when he got home.
Mm-hmm.
And he found something, you know, like the turning point of his life. And then that taught him, and that's where we get like the montage or, mm-hmm. you know, the training sequence. And we can show how he goes and uses those life experiences and sees what a difference his new worldview has. Mm-hmm. This worldview where Christ is telling him to forgive people.
Yeah. Gosh, and it was Billy Graham too. It was a Billy Graham crusade that
yeah,
did it.
Yeah, and it was a
and it was,
it'd have been great if that could have been included.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But when I like, okay, I'm reading this in the book and... She's very... Laura Helen Brand is a great writer. This book is riveting the whole time. And she describes, like, this young, blonde-headed kid coming off a train, like, in L.A., and his name is Billy Graham. And I was like, this isn't the Billy Graham I know, is it? Like, is this a joke? Like, this is for real? This really happened? It was just crazy to read that. But I really want to pose a question to both of you guys about basically what we're talking about. We're saying that all of us sensed a great... like an emptiness.
Thought.
Yeah, totally incomplete. But I'm wondering, so all the interviews that I read about Jolie and the Zamperinis' reaction to the film is that they like the way that it ended because they wanted to leave it open-ended for any person of any like faith or belief system
of course
to get
do.
Something from the film.
Sure.
And so I'm wondering if... I mean, is this film being inspirational to people in a way that we have not felt inspired? And if so, what is the message that is inspiring them?
Oh, I think it has to be inspiring to people who want to come at it from any angle. There are plenty of humanists that this would be great for. It would just cater to all their whims. And I mean that with some respect because, I am a human being. So when I'm carnally living through my own passions, it's quite easy to just assume the humanist point of view and think like a humanist does. The humanism is not like an organized religion. What it is it's just the outworking of who we are carnally inside is the flesh. And sometimes we work together to build upon our interests, and sometimes we work separately. So you have someone like Cain who is looking out just for himself in the humanist sort of way. And then you have someone else like King Nebuchadnezzar who's thinking about only himself and the interests of his entire culture from a humanistic point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And in this movie and the execution behind it, I think that's probably the prevailing problem is, you know, as our friend Michael Menkoff likes to say, empty wineskins. There's a a passage in the New Testament, I believe it is, where there's this idea that you can fill it up with anything that you want to believe and put into it. The movie is just a vessel, and you as a person in the audience who comes in with your own faith and values, you watch this and you fill it with your own values mm-hmm. and say, oh, I see how this works. I can really back him up now. I have my reasons to hate these Japanese dudes for what they're doing. Of course, it's not fair to treat this Italian kid this way and, you know, pick on him and, you know, in the hometown. And, oh, man, look at his courage, you know, when he was dealing with and helping his fellow soldiers and officers. Mm-hmm. Like, he's kind of a noble guy. He wasn't trying to lay down his life for his friends, but he was a noble guy. And mm-hmm. then along the way, you get suckered into, you know, like taking the higher and mightier approach. Oh, I'm so much better than all these people on screen. Right. And that's what
I
think.
If I can take it, I can make it.
Yeah. And so when there comes that moment that he is going to take it and make it by holding up his beam, you're like, yeah. And I think everybody in the football stadium goes, oorah, or whatever they do. And they just love that moment and they cheer. You know, but the thing is, I think you've nailed it. It is allowing people to just believe whatever they want to believe and get something from this film.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I would say, I believe, I'm pretty sure it was, again, Alyssa Wilkinson's article at Christianity Today that towards the end, she said, is this film inspiring, basically, mm-hmm. asking a rhetorical question. It's like, sure, of course it's inspiring, but what is it inspiring us to do? Mm-hmm. And I think, Joe, you've kind of hit it on the head. You know, it inspires certain people certain ways and certain people the other ways. But ultimately, I think if you don't have the context of his bigger story, then the only way the movie can really inspire you, unless that one sentence at the end, you know, the little crawl sentence that says, you know, he forgave his enemies. I think the only way that it can really inspire you is to look inward to yourself.
Yeah. And find the strength within.
Yeah.
It's there.
You know, look inward. And I think that is something that the three of us would say, like I said, Joe has basically already kind of explained, is not what we believe.
Yeah.
You know, we actually believe that, you know, we can't look inside ourselves and find anything greater. We can't overcome by ourselves. We need something,
or at least that it has a pretty quick limit.
or you know, you're gonna it's gonna run out very mm-hmm. quickly. And so, what does it, you know, is it inspiring? Yes, I think the best that we could hope to get from this movie, and why it felt like an incomplete thought, or it fell a little flat, even though it did take us through these incredible things that he survived, was because at best, I hope it inspires people of faith to go and learn about his whole life.
Right.
And this isn't even necessarily a criticism of what they chose to do to try to get it out to people. I mean, because I understand that to a certain degree. I don't necessarily think that if you, like Cynthia Garris, Zamperini's daughter, says, if you talk about Jesus, people wouldn't want to see the film. Mm-hmm. I think you can talk about Jesus in popular film. You just have to be honest.
Well, and I think a film like this is such an incredible place to do that, because people can't look at it and say, oh, they're trying to shove this message down my throat, because they'll watch this film and say, oh, this is what happened. I'm watching what happened. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
Well, not only that, but
it gives you like a free pass talk about Jesus.
Well, I think it points to Zamperini not being a perfect person. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the most important things. I think most Christian films, when they have the you know, the protagonist who is doing the sinful thing, it's always some like super stereotyped or
like Eric, you know, Little in The Chariots of Fire.
Yeah.
I watched it.
You know, we're okay with that kind of sin.
Yeah, can I explain the connection for a second?
Yeah.
Sure. Okay, thank you. The Chariots of Fire, there are these two main characters. They're both kind of protagonists, but the one he uses is his anger. He's got his dark side issues. He's the Jew. He's got dark hair. He actually looks a lot like this Zamperini. And his problem is that he's got to be number one. He has to be number one, and anything less than that is not good enough for him.
If
and
then if along
comes Eric, yeah, you know, like then Eric Little comes along, and he makes getting first place look easy. He's always getting all the ribbons. He's always breaking records. And this just eats up the Jew because he knows he's not as good as Eric. And he can't get over his contention with him, even though they've never met, even though Eric has not done anything to offend him. This guy looks like he's ready to bite off his head. But then when it comes right down to it, it doesn't matter how angry you get. You're not going to beat Eric Little in the end of the race because you're not actually as good at it biologically as a performer, as a runner. But that's like the one lesson that that guy learns, that no amount of bitterness or anger is going to be able to beat Eric Little. But then as it relates to Eric's story, you see throughout the film that he always gives the credit back to God. He's always saying, hey, it's not me. It's I can't do this. But I take joy in every moment that God gives me, and I do everything that I can to, like, I do it as unto the Lord. And mm-hmm. so that's what Eric is going to do. And he'd be happy to fail, but do it as unto the Lord with all of his heart, give it his best shot. And he would have been okay with that. He wouldn't have, you know, had a problem with the Jew like the Jew had a problem with him. And this isn't to say, oh, all Christians have got it figured out, and they know what to do. You know, no. More like y'all were saying, we're flawed too, and that's probably one of the shortcomings of Chariots of Fire, is that it feels unrelatable because Eric is a bit too perfect. He's a mm-hmm. bit too Christ-like mm-hmm. for anybody's tastes, and it makes him unrelatable to the large majority of the audience. You wind up watching that film, and even though you kind of know the Jew is supposed to be the bad guy, you wind up relating to him more than you do mm-hmm. Eric. And so in contrast with Unbroken, it feels like we are actually dealing with Zamperini, who represents both of those characters combined. And on the one hand, there's something noble about him, which hasn't come to fruition. And then you've got the other part of him that is fueled by his anger. So he's kind of like a high-functioning Two-Face from the Batman. He's got it under control when he needs it, and then the other times he's gonna just be the noble, you know, lawyer dude or you know, district attorney. And, you know, that's what Zamperini feels like in the film. Mm-hmm. So when he needs to channel the dark side or his light side to accomplish something right, he'll do it.
Yeah, I just when I think about what it took to overcome that, I can't not be impressed. And I can't, even when I think about like the amount of hatred or defiance he used,
mm-hmm.
I mean, there's something impressive about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know what? That's just loose screws on the part of the story, because you almost got the impression that Phil should have made a bigger, profounder impression on him. But then mm-hmm. when he exits the picture, you don't get the impression that it changed Louis for the better, that Phil made a profound impression on him. You never got the impression that it was because of Phil that Louis became a better person. Mm-hmm. And I know that might have been untrue to the historical account, and perhaps why it wasn't pursued in the script. Then again, maybe it was true. I don't know. But I wanted to ask you, Laura, because something I read was that the man, Zamperini himself, when asked about where he got his endurance to hold mm-hmm. up the beam, he said, I don't know where it came from. It just kind of came from somewhere deep within, and I was able to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so what did he mean by that? Did the book explain that better? Because that is the pivotal moment.
Yeah. I think that from what I remember, I think that he would have said that it was like staring that man in the face and saying, you won't beat me. I mean, that was where he was at.
It was the competitor and, spirit.
Yeah, it was. And even like, I think he held that beam for 30 minutes. Somebody was timing him, like his buddies were watching the clock. And he didn't even know that he was holding it that long. Like he kind of like went inside and yeah. was not like, I think he was even like losing consciousness a little bit as he was standing there. Like he wasn't even fully cognitively there. He doesn't even remember doing it. Mm-hmm. As long as he did it. So there wasn't... I think
they characterized that very well in the film.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. So it wasn't like some kind of like... I don't even really know if it was like a cognitive decision, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, it was just like, this is something I got to do and I got to do it right now or I'm going to die.
Well, so, and that's part of the problem with that being the pinnacle,
mm-hmm.
because that's not the pinnacle of his life.
Yeah.
You know, like that's not the, you know, the peak of his life story, but it's the peak of the movie, which only further pushes that, like, what is driving him to hold the beam? Like, mm-hmm. what is driving him to do that? And it is his hatred. It's his, you know, his hatred, and he will not lose this battle of will to the bird. And then that you know, and then the movie kind of was like, well, look, he didn't lose to the bird. That's the point of the movie. And that's not the point of his life.
Right.
And that's why the story of Zamperini is amazing, but Unbroken the movie is okay.
Yeah. You know, it's so interesting. I'm actually trying to find this in the book right now. This made me really sad to read that. Oh, here it is. Okay, so Pete, she has like a little afterword about him in here about how his family kind of noted that, you know, if it bothered him that Louis was getting all this fame and recognition and he wasn't, then he was a very humble, quiet man. He never made a big deal about it.
Wait, who?
I'm sorry, Phil.
Okay.
Yeah, Phil. But that he, I mean, you know, he was really a footnote in Louis's story.
Mm.
And he would show up sometimes to things where events where they were, you know, telling his story and his whole family were there and he would take pictures with them, but he'd kind of step in the background. And that towards the end of his life in a rest home, somebody found out about what his, you know, who he was and what his life had entailed. And they threw him like a recognition party and they all just sat around and listened to him tell stories, his own story. And his kids kind of described him as kind of having this like, it just being a moment where it was like, this is me, you know, like my story is important. And that really like kind of broke my heart. And it made me think think about this phenomenon that his, I mean, like, okay, so none of us had heard about Louis' story before, but it's becoming really widely known now. And he was like asked to speak constantly. That's how he made his living, is by traveling and speaking about his story.
Mm-hmm.
So why Louis and not Phil? Mm. I mean, is it because, I think it's probably because of his personality and the part of his story about him being an Olympian as well. But, you know, like I guess what I'm saying is there is something special about Louis, like the person,
mm-hmm.
Because, you know, he's the one on the screen. He's the one getting the recognition and really has always been. And Phil is not. And Phil went through very similar circumstances. So, yeah, what is it about Louis and not Phil? You know what I'm saying?
I have an idea. Let me play the devil's advocate from a sort of a out there artistic interpretation of the situation with this film. Maybe in spite of what the filmmakers did, we have something that we can look, you know, like you just take a different vantage point. One way as Christians we can still appreciate this film that we haven't discovered yet is that if this film were called something else, okay, here I'm thinking out loud.
Okay, but I have give us another title.
I have an idea. Here's the thing. It's called Unbroken, right?
Mm-hmm.
And during the film, he doesn't go through genuine conversion. We know that based on the true story. What happens when you get to conversion? Well, first you have to be broken before you're willing to lay down your life and take up your cross and follow Jesus, before you're ready to make the real redemption moment happen, when you're allowing God to come into your life, when you're allowing to him to become the ruler of your life.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something where your spirit has to be broken, where you have to acknowledge that you are prepared to find the Savior of the world to save your life, because you can't save yourself. And I know the film is not pitched this way, but from a ultra-sensitive, mindful Christian point of view, if this film had been called Broken, I would have said, but why? At the end of the film, Mm-hmm. He hasn't turned a new leaf. He doesn't have a change of heart. He is still the angry man inside. The only thing is that now we know that he is back in the U.S. He's probably not going to die by his attackers and by his tormentors. And there is something else that I think that this... I've noticed that sometimes the Lord works in mysterious ways through films that don't seem to work from our point of view. Mm-hmm. That somehow inadvertently, you know, man screws it up, but God is still able to use it. And mm-hmm. it works through people's lives and they have a revelation of their own. Like some people we don't know are going to check out this story now because of the movie. Whether they see the movie or not, they're going to take an interest in Louis Zamperini. Mm-hmm. And by that alone and their interest in the book, they're probably going to have a new appreciation for Christianity that we don't often have at the current time. Thinking about Eric Riddle, that guy's story was profoundly effective in its time when that mm-hmm. movie came out. It stood for, this is what Christianity is all about. Check out this movie. This is who we want you to think about when, or this is like the characterization of Christianity we want. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What we have here is not a Christian. This guy, you know, begs God to save his life in the storm, and then he weathers everything of his own sheer will power. You saw that from the beginning to the end. His brother tells him, hey, if you're willing to suffer some momentary pain, you can have a lifetime of glory. His brother tells him that while he's getting onto the train. And Louis kind of looks at him like, I don't understand what you're saying, but I know you really mean for it to have a profound impact on me. So I appreciate you, brother. And he had that look in his eyes like, I don't know what you're saying. Mm-hmm. You know, what he didn't realize, it was kind of prophetic.
Yeah.
And just the last note on this like alternate point of view. I know I'm getting a little bit nerdy because I am a designer and I have a background in the arts and the Darnells. We just sort of have an eye for this sort of thing. Filmmakers and artists everywhere kind of stick to the same template when it comes to visual stimulation and what it represents formulaically. So like, for instance, we all know that God is characterized as the light. Mm-hmm. And the Almighty God, you could say the Lord himself, is represented in a light that is so blinding you cannot see him through the light. Another thing that we know is that if you have a person in a visual image representation that seems to have like an aura of light shining out of him, then not just light on him, but like the way you characterize it visually, that you enhance the picture or the brush strokes or whatever it is about your film to present this guy who looks like he has an aura of glory radiating out of him. You're saying that he's pure, he is spiritual, he has got integrity about him, that he is pure of heart, that he must be wise, that he's a mm-hmm. little bit angelic, that he's a spiritual person. And you see this kind of imagery in a lot of artwork and in movies. So a great example of this off the top of my head would be the Lady Galadriel in Peter Jackson's films. Mm-hmm. Because she's supposed to be this perfect-ish kind of icon, she has an aura that glows right out of her. Mm-hmm. Now, with that in mind, if you look at the Unbroken poster, you have Zamperini, and he is the Dark Man. He is black. There is no light within him. And he's holding up his cross. And he is facing the light. Hmm. He's not facing the enemy. He's not facing Watanabe. Mm-hmm. It's like there's this irony to the poster that he is standing before God holding up his own cross and saying, I can save myself.
I gotta go look at some movie posters.
And yeah, again, cool. I don't think that this is intentional, but it's like, I think that God, working in mysterious ways, knows mm-hmm. how man uses these devices and mm-hmm. this kind of imagery, that any Christian who is aware of the arts and how this stuff is portrayed would say, oh, wow, look at that. And nobody even knows. Nobody mm-hmm. even appreciates this.
Yeah. No, I can even see that... that's a great point, because I can think about different parts of the film and realize that there are things that are being communicated not through language, that do carry some of that message that we felt were missing. I mean, that scene in the raft with him and Phil talking about faith is a very poignant moment that I think was given its due. And so, there are definitely parts of the film that are saying something other than, you know, be hateful and it'll get you through the hard times.
Well, I feel like we have exhausted most of the main points.
Yeah.
I think most of the things that I really wanted us to touch on, and we're getting about that time anyway. So we've pointed out that it's not the best film in the entire world for a couple reasons. Though, you know, we definitely wouldn't say it's a bad movie.
Yeah.
No, it's, I would definitely not, say not, to d- see it.
You know, we would, you know,
yeah.
But I think we'd be on the positive side. Mm-hmm. But as usual, there are a couple things that can annoy us, can let us down, and we could have done without, maybe. So Joe, what would you characterize as maybe a thing or a... Actually, you said there probably aren't any characters, but a moment or anything like that that just kind of struck you wrong and made you kind of say, come on, or that you wish was a little bit better.
One thing that struck me wrong is that when they switched the actors from the children that were playing Zamperini and his brother, older brother, to the main actor, the star of the film, and another guy that was playing his older brother, that I totally thought that both Louis were good lookalikes, but his older brother, I didn't think it was the same guy. So when he was hugging his brother on the train station, I was like, okay, I guess you must be his brother because we have not been introduced to this guy. Mm-hmm. But you don't look anything like his brother, and it's only been a few years. That was my really, come on, the kind of thing. I guess a negative. But again, it was one of those things you get quickly over because I think later in the film they establish better that he is Louis' brother. When they're concerned and they're standing in the living room and listening to the radio.
Yeah.
My come on moment is actually a moment that I thought was well illustrated considering it actually happened when Watanabe ended up being the person who was in charge of the coal mines.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was like, are you kidding me? Is that an exaggeration? Did they just add that to the story? You know, because that was completely unnecessary. That's so cliche. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it was true.
Yeah.
But it was true.
Was that stranger than fiction, right?
Yeah. It was.
Nothing stranger than real life.
And so your main thing was the fact that puberty had some kind of weird twist on Zamperini's brother.
Yes.
Oh my god!
Complete facial reconstruction.
Oh, all right. So Laura, where did you land on that?
Well, I'm going to sound like a broken record, but honestly, as I was watching the film, I can't think of a single moment where I was taken out of the film because of something that happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think that is, you know, well to its credit. But I also want to stress, as I say, what my come on is, that I had not finished the book yet. I hadn't even gotten to like the part where he went to the coal mine in the book. So I didn't know the end of Louis' story, but at the end of the film, when it said, and he forgave all his captors, I was like, what? I was like, there's your story right there.
Huh.
Yeah. There it is.
You just missed the boat.
Yeah, you just totally missed that, because it didn't even say anything about him being a Christian. I didn't look at it from a Christian standpoint at all. And I thought, whoa, what?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And honestly, when I think of Louis' story, I know a lot of stuff happened to him, but I do think about it in three acts. I think of the kid who became an Olympian, the bombardier who became a POW,
mm-hmm.
and the broken man who became a Christian and forgave his captor. So I think that there are actually three pretty distinct acts there. But anyway, that is, you know, I won't say anything else about it. That's my come on moment. And I think it's legit because I didn't finish the book yet.
Well, and you know, we've obviously tread this ground, but I think that's a perfectly legitimate, you know, thing to be annoyed at, because we recently watched Selma, and we'll do that. We'll cover that on this not on this podcast, but on another episode. One of my main fears about Selma was something, looking back at this film, I would have had I known what happened in the book.
Mm.
And going into Selma, I really, really respect Martin Luther King Jr., but one of my fears was that when you put that story in certain people's hands, it can be about a man who did and initiated great things just because they were the right thing to do, mm-hmm. because everyone knows that that's the right thing to do.
They were moral giants.
Yeah, they were morally ahead of their time, mm-hmm. and you know, a very quasi-humanist approach to things. Like they're good, they were better than the other people around them, and so they knew the right thing to do when people didn't know what the mm-hmm. right thing was. When in fact, one of the reasons that I really respect Martin Luther King Jr. is because, you know, he didn't argue for, you know, less Christianity, less things that separated Christians from everyone else to bring everyone together. He's, you know, he would say the reason, the thing that brought everyone together is because, or the thing that they needed more of was the gospel. Mm-hmm. They're like, if you're racist, you need more of the gospel. So, you know, you see why racism isn't the answer. You know, if you hate your neighbor, you need more of the gospel so you understand forgiveness. Things like that. And that's the backbone of his story. And I was afraid they would take that out. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like that's very similar to what we get in this story, where the whole, like, what was it worth?
Yeah.
Why did it matter that you went through these things?
It's what makes it make sense.
Yeah. And, you know, if you take that very important thing away, then I feel like you miss the entire point of why things happened. Mm-hmm. And so that's totally a valid thing.
Is it your come on moment too?
And like I said, it's my come on piece to the overarching story.
Okay.
But in the movie, kind of like Joe did, you know, there's the concept that the problem, and then there's a specific issue if I want to nitpick. And because for the most part, I was in the story the whole time.
Yeah.
Except okay. for his older brother.
Again,
but not because of his unfortunate pubescent
transition journey.
Yeah, journey. Yeah, not for that reason, but because I basically felt like, and heck, you know, just to take an aside, this might have been another great reason to have it in a miniseries, not mm-hmm. a movie. Is I felt like his older brother was underdeveloped, and thus every time he was on screen, I felt like he was this walking inspirational quote machine.
Okay.
You know, he's just like, hey, you know, I'm your brother, and if you can take it, you can make it.
Yeah.
Yep. Hey, Louis, I'm your brother. A moment of pain is worth a lifetime of glory. I'm like, do you ever speak in just like normal words, or are you like this one big Max Lucado? Like, you know, so, you know, it's just really annoying because I wanted, you know, all his things were just like, like I said, things you'd read on a fortune cookie or something, mm-hmm. you know, not really deep things, the kind of things that you would need to, I think, really get through,
yeah.
That kind of thing.
Gosh, I can totally see that now you say it. But I knew his character from mm-hmm. the book, so I knew that he was, like, the driving force behind Louis. So,
yeah, so it was just...
But
yeah.
You're right, that's so true.
But that's basically, anytime he was on, he just came on, mm-hmm. here's an inspirational quote, you know.
Let me change your life for you.
Yeah,
bye.
And so, but, so yeah, that was that. But like we do,
I agree. And they also seemed to downplay his parents' involvement as well. They just mm-hmm. they were there, but they didn't have anything to say. Mm-hmm. Obviously, yeah. They got emotional about some of the things that Louis did as a child, but they were mostly just showing, not telling. And so we mm-hmm. don't know much about their opinions, where they were coming at it, whether they had reason to believe maybe we shouldn't believe the news bulletins, or maybe they just had their faith in God. Were they Christians? We don't know, except that they were going to church at the beginning. But it also seems like, you know, a lot of people went to church back then, not because they were Christians, but just because you do.
Yeah, it was a very cultural thing mm-hmm. to do.
So I don't know. Like, I'm going to put them in the same boat with the brother, that they were just there. Mm-hmm. To represent some sort of, like, I got to get back to my family. There's no place like home. But mm-hmm. besides that, they were just poster boards. They didn't do anything.
I would say that this is definitely an ideal place where it wouldn't have never... In a miniseries, it wouldn't... Like, episode one, exploring the family, would not have... Even maybe part of episode two... of a miniseries of Unbroken would not have probably ever been anyone's favorite, but it would have set the table mm-hmm. for everything else that happens in his life, and it would give it more meaning, because it reminds me of, like, for people who've seen Band of Brothers.
I was just thinking about that. I was like, put Tom Hanks on this.
Yeah.
Let's do this.
So in Band of Brothers, the first episode of Band of Brothers is probably, I wouldn't say people's least favorite episode, because it makes it sound like a bad episode, but it's one of the least action-packed, you know, whatever episodes. It's just mm-hmm. them training, running up and down Kurahee over and over and over again, and everyone hating David Schwimmer's Captain Sobel, you know? Mm-hmm. But them, you know, going through the training and then all together hating Captain Sobel and then being free from that, like, that sets those relationships up, and that sets those motivations and those camaraderies up for every episode after it. And, you know, so that first episode could have just been like, hey, we had this guy, he was hard on us, and it sucked. But, you know, you had an hour-long episode to explore that and then move on from there. And that gave every character so much life and so much purpose. And, like I said, basically, this is going to be like an hour and a half long pitch for us to try to get Unbroken made as a miniseries. But, you know, like I said, it's just more examples to me of when you have a story that's, you know, this involved and this long and this true, like, you could really do some great things with this. Mm-hmm. And so, like I said, that was it was a letdown because of that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, well, I think there was another great quote. It said, like, this definitely isn't a bad movie. It's actually a pretty good movie. Bad movies get made every year. Heck, bad movies get made every week, you know, and this isn't one of them. But knowing what it could have been. And I think we've said that about a couple movies that came out in 2014. But, before I go on more, we're going to...
Good moments.
Switch gears.
Yeah.
To good moments or great moments. So, Joe, what was it about this movie that you just really liked?
There were a few. One of them was the shark fight. Was came out of left field. Yeah, suddenly attacking and eating the shark. I was like, no way! It's the most macho thing I've seen all year. I haven't watched a lot of football. And
football's so macho.
Yeah. Then I would also say that it was just pretty impressive what the guys lived through when they went into the coal mine. Just like grimy all the time. So an unhospitable environment, so unhealthy, and impressed me that anybody could live through that.
Mm-hmm.
I know that doesn't sound like much. It has more to do with the story than anything that this film accomplished. And I think that's sort of in keeping what we've already described. But that was like, there ain't no way. You don't come from that. You know, you don't get escape this. This is where everybody dies, right? They don't need to shoot you. You're just dead meat because of how the living conditions were so horrible. And I couldn't imagine that the food was good. I can't imagine that they had a proper exposure to any sort of exercise. I mean, like, this is what the children of Israel went through in Egypt, only worse. They're just dealing with coal rather than building pyramids. They're doing coal. And that's just, man, it was so rough.
Mm-hmm.
I have a hard time imagining anyone living through that. And so I was impressed that there were as many survivors as there were.
Yeah. Well, that foot injury kept him from going to the next Olympics. And, I mean, he ran the torch, but he never competed again. Like the foot injury we saw in the film.
Yeah.
Some bad stuff going on.
Well, Laura?
I was really impressed that they could film the, like, stranded on the ocean part in a way that it was actually interesting and not just, like, people floating around. And it was pretty long, you know? It wasn't like they highlighted the one day where they caught the albatross or something. You know, the sharks were there. I mean, it was pretty long. So I think when I look back on it and think about, like, really moving moments that, like, brought me, that, like, touched something in me and made me emotional, would be when Mac dies. And, like, that to me is pretty redemptive because, like, he ate all the chocolate at the beginning of their, you know, crash. And that was, like, all their food. And And he, like, felt really guilty about that, you know? And then at the end, they were all huddled around him, being really good friends and helping him usher him into the next life. And also the moment where he hits the shark with the oar, you know, he's like deadpan, and then suddenly the shark jumps up on the raft and he is alive. You know, Mac is alive, and everybody looks at him like, like, what just happened? We thought you weren't even like here cognitively. So I think that whole part was just like felt really redemptive to me. And Phil and Louis were just so kind, and you know,
yeah.
Anyway, so that, I mean, that made me pretty emotional. And then honestly, at the end when they showed like the clip of like the real Louis running the Olympic torch felt pretty emotional to me.
So. And all of the sequence on the rafts gave them the best camaraderie you see in the entire film.
Yeah.
I would have liked more of that when they got to the POW situation.
Mm-hmm. Oh, because there certainly was, you know, they had to have friendship there.
You know, if they made it into a miniseries.
but Mikey, what do you think?
We need to make t-shirts that just say
if they had made it into a miniseries. What do you think about if they made it into a miniseries?
Well, I would say for my part, because I felt like the film started like on a note and it more or less stayed on that note the entire time.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think it, the film wants to think that it goes up a notch mm-hmm. towards the end. It didn't really go up a notch for me. Mm-hmm. It just kind of started, you know, semi-intense and stayed intense.
Yeah, I agree with that.
There wasn't like a moment where I felt more engaged than another. So the thing that I really liked was how some scenes were done.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, I think it's because I just love war films for whatever weird reason. I just really like when they're in the bomber and they have like the dogfight scenes and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I just thought they were filmed pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
I thought they were interesting and they were really entertaining to
watch. I agree. I really enjoyed them.
And you know, I think you can get away with some really lazy filmmaking, making like bomber dogfight scenes. You know, like you film a dude who goes from left to right with his machine gun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I think you can do it lazily, because you know you're not like two planes fighting each other. You know, he's chasing, he's not chasing. He does this, he follows him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like a car chase scene or a plane chase scene. It's a stationary object just trying to defend things coming at it.
Right.
And I thought it was done really well, which is one of the things, like, I was fairly impressed with, and I talked this about at the beginning, with Angelina Jolie's directing, because I felt like with what she had and the arc that she went on,
mm-hmm.
She allowed her cinematographer to do very well, and they told the story in a very engaging way.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and that's just probably my prime example of it. So. Right. That was great, and I was impressed because I expected him to kind of gloss over it.
Mm-hmm.
So,
very good point.
Well, so as we wind down and wrap up, final thoughts, Joe.
I'm looking forward to seeing the film again at home, sharing it with more people, talking about it more. I'm glad this kind of story is out there. We don't have enough of these stories. I mean, it's a rotten shame more people don't have awesome stories about surviving POW camps. No, you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I mean, like, really the story of the book. It's too bad we don't have more of the stories found in the book. But it's mm-hmm. great that we have a film that brought attention to it.
Agreed.
Mm-hmm.
Laura?
Read the book. Oh my gosh.
Mm-hmm.
It's incredible. And she and Hillenbrand does that. She gives other people's stories a moment to shine. And they're just, I mean, the book is full of people who endured incredible things. And you can't, I mean, there are things that you can't imagine people did to each other and things you can't imagine they survived, you know? So it's such an interesting book. And it's so, it's written so engagingly for, you know, for such a hard story. So that's what I would say.
This episode of Real World Theology brought to you by Paper World Theology.
Read books.
Where we read, which means Mikey will never be on this podcast.
Yeah. Okay. Read World Theology.
There. Yeah. Read World Theology. A sister podcast. Do you ever wake up in the morning and want to read a book? Do you? I don't know why everyone who wants to buy something always wakes up in the morning. Okay, so I would say that, unfortunately, I don't have a great desire to ever see this movie again. Because I don't think, like I said, they told the whole story. And I don't really need to see him going through all that stuff again for not a whole... What I would say is not a whole lot of purpose. But I would encourage people to watch it once,
mm-hmm.
at least. And then really think about what you get from it.
Yeah.
Because as we talked about in the show, it is inspiring. But I really want you to think about what it inspires you to do. Does it inspire you to, you know, to push harder, to be better than you think you can be, to strive for things that you don't think, you know, you could achieve or are worthy of achieving? I think that's admirable.
Mm-hmm.
But what I hope it does, it inspires you to really learn about that aspect of forgiveness that they kind of gloss over. And how that forgiveness came to be. And for all, you know, hopefully read the book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Laura's told me enough about it that I would almost want to read it if I had more time.
If you read books.
If I read books.
Yeah, that's a great place to end, Mikey. I think back on Alyssa Wilkinson's question that you said, you know, what does it inspire you to do? That doesn't necessarily mean there's one answer, that it's that we're saying that the film inspires you to do awful things. But mm-hmm. but yeah, to look closely at what is it inspiring to do? Is that a good or a bad thing? You know?
I mean, and in this particular case, I think if nothing else, it made me want to learn more about him.
Right.
Because I'm like, you know, how did you get to this mm-hmm. this one sentence summation at the end of the movie?
And that's what the Zamperini said. That's why they liked it being left that way, is because they all the publicity says that they were, you know, their position was it opens doors, it makes people ask questions.
Yeah.
You know.
And, you know, that's one of those 50-50 things for me. I think they're 50% wrong and 50% right, you know. So hopefully, like Joe mentioned earlier, you know, God can use anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I definitely think he's obviously using Zamperini's life. And hopefully this will be an avenue into that life.
Mm-hmm.
And kudos to that. You know, like, you know, that's right. A great thing. So we have really appreciated everyone hanging in there. And I've appreciated my guests for joining me to talk about this and listening to my crazy idea about an Unbroken miniseries. But
I think that was Joe's idea first.
Well, I think it was Joe's idea, but I totally hijacked it.
Yes, you did.
I stared Joe down in my hatred, and I said, Joe will not win.
This will now be my idea.
Well, that's what all the good hosts do.
That's what I like to
think. That's why they have guests. Take their ideas.
That's why we don't have co-hosts. We have guests.
Right.
Because I had a co-host and then I killed him with my mind. But anyway, so I'm very...
The truth finally comes out.
Just gloss right over that.
I'm glad I was on this episode. The last episode of Real World Theology.
Ever. Well, we end at, what are we on, like 49 or something like that? We'd never make it to 50. But yeah, I really appreciate you guys being here and talking about this this really interesting film, and I want people to be able to continue that discussion. And so I want people to be able to continue that discussion with you guys. So, how, Joe, can people find you and the things that you do?
I am online. I'm on the interwebs. I go to Twitter. I'm @_JoeDarnell, and my website is joedarnell.com. And my new podcast is topbrew.fm. And you should be able to find that on iTunes sometime next week. And if you want to hear, that's just the way that iTunes
works.
Not
for lack of trying.
No. And the other movie podcast that really was the inspiration for Real World Theology. No. The other podcast I'm on is Movie Bite. And you can find that at moviebite.com.
Nice, and I'll make sure I have all that in the show notes. Laura, how can people get a hold of you and or follow what you do?
Actually, speaking of books, on my website, I review books that I read.
So. Read World Theology?
That's right.
No, it's this is happening.
Copyright Joan Arnell.
All of our good ideas are Joe's ideas. So my website is laurafissel.com, and I post book reviews there. I try to post about things that inspire me, music, films, art, clothes, anything that inspires me. And and there's some links to the novels that I'm to some information about the novels that I am writing. You can't read them yet, but so all my stuff is there. Oh, and you can follow me on Twitter at Laura_Fissel.
Sweet. And finally, you can follow me at Fizzification on the Twitters, or you can follow this show at Real World Theo. If you'd like to know more about Real World Theology, then please visit our website, realworldtheology.com. That's R-E-E-L, worldtheology.com, which hopefully you always already found downloading this episode or looking at the show notes. Connect with us on Facebook, subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. And if you enjoy it, please, please, please review the show. I'm a personal fan of 5-star ratings. I think that Louis Zamperini would give this show 5 stars.
I agree.
You know,
if he were still alive,
if he were with us, and someone showed him how to use the iTunes, then
he was
a pretty savvy guy.
Oh yeah.
See, I don't know that. I didn't read the book.
He picked up skateboarding when he was like 75.
Of course he did. Why wouldn't he? Because he can do everything. So if you want to be like Zamperini, give this show 5 stars.
Oh, gosh. The views spoken by Mikey Fissel are not reflecting of other guests.
Well, again, I just want to thank those guests for being here. So thank you, Joe. Thank you, Laura.
You're welcome.
Yay. I want to thank you, the listeners, for taking time to make us part of your week. And until next episode, remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Good night. Or goodbye. Wherever you are, whatever time you're listening to this.
Whatever o'clock. This podcast is a member of the Crossover Nexus. To find out more or to hear about other podcasts that engage faith and pop culture, please go to www.crossovernexus.com. Do you wake up wanting to conquer the world?
That's right.
But you wonder how that's going to happen with all those eye boogers.
Wow.
Have you tried coffee?